portion of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled A Shared Fate by Madeline Bowden. Scientists worldwide have tracked worrying declines in insects and the birds that feast on them. In Vermont, researchers are searching for clues that could help save them both. Less than 2 hours after sunrise, with the shadows still blue and slanting hard and a dense growth of balsam firs and spruces, the baby bird blundered into a fine black net strung along the ridgeline of Mount Mansfield at 4,393 feet from Vermont's tallest mountain. Desiree Narango, conservation scientist with the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, or VCE, retrieved the rescued bird and with practiced fingers spread one of its wings like a fan. Narango could see that the slate-colored bird was a dark-eyed junco, a sparrow species found in various color combinations across North America. The bird was just a few weeks out from leaving its nest. It was too young to tell its sex. But she was less interested in the bird itself than what it had been eating. Juncos are known as seed-eating birds. They spend their days rummaging through the undergrowth searching for fallen seeds. At feeders, they prefer smaller grains like millet. But seeds don't provide the protein juncos or any songbirds need to grow a new set of feathers while they molt. And the protein this baby junco needs to molt its blotchy juvenile feathers and to grow sleek stone-gray feathers on top and white ones below would only come from bugs. In fact, 90% of the more than 10,700 known bird species rely on insects for food during at least part of their life cycle. Even the most dedicated seed-eating songbirds must eat insects and other arthropods, a many-legged group of creatures that include spiders and millipedes, produce eggs to grow new feathers and to feed their young. Without insects, in other words, they wouldn't survive. Unfortunately, insects are just disappearing at a rate of about 1 to 2% a year, and the decline is not limited to just one species, nor just one group of insects. The data suggests that the decline is widespread, even global. These findings have been confirmed in hundreds of rigorous peer-reviewed studies, says David L. Wagner, of University of Connecticut entomologist and lead scientist of a program known as the Status of Insects, which coordinates pertinent research on insect populations from around the world. The weight of the evidence is clear, Wagner says. I feel like it would stand up in a court of law. Narango, who is now one of dozens of researchers participating in the project, was a city kid from Baltimore with her heart set on becoming a zookeeper. Her undergraduate program at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry required a summer semester at a biological field station in the Adirondacks. She'd never been camping or even to the woods. On the tree-crowded shores of the mountain lake, she was captivated by the bouncy, fluty song of an unseen bird. By the time she figured out that it came from the white-throated sparrow, her future had been mapped. Today, she investigates the relationship between the worldwide decline in insects and a worldwide decline in birds. The bird cradled in her hand up on Mount Mansfield holds some of the answers to the mystery behind these trends. Bees, butterflies, moths, flies, beetles, ants, and a few other insects pollinate three-quarters of the world's flowering plants and crops. Their pollination services are worth up to $577 billion per year worldwide. Less well known is their critical role in helping dead things disappear. Piles of leaves and rotting stumps, the rat in the street, the elephant on the savanna, the contents of your compost bin. Insects also feed on feces, cleaning up the messes of wild and domestic animals. Dung beetles provide $380 million a year in manure recycling for the American cattle industry. All of these cleanup activities create soil for new plant growth. Insects feed many animals we eat, such as trout, salmon, and turkeys. In some places, they feed us directly. More than 2,000 species of insect are eaten by people around the world. And that's not even considering honey. Bugs also keep each other under control. Ladybugs eat the aphids in your garden. Praying mantises eat flies, moths, roaches, grasshoppers, and more. Dragonflies patrol the skies, eating flies, midges, and mosquitoes. Some wasps are clever parasites, paralyzing other insects, including some we don't like, to feed their young. Simply put, insects are vital for the survival of land-based life on this planet. Ellen Welty, a research ecologist with the Smithsonian's Great Plains Science Program, says there are two groups of people who study insects, those who look at them as pests or carriers of disease, and those who study insects' roles in natural systems. While most insect researchers look for better ways to control grasshoppers on rangelands, Welty says, she studies how, for example, grasshoppers benefit grasslands by providing enough fertilizer through their frass, that is, poop, to increase the yield of next year's grasses, which outweighs the damage they do to eating this year's grasses. The Status of Insects project led by Wagner helps scientists like Welty fill gaps and coordinate their research. The network doesn't just focus on the glamorous insects, such as butterflies, bees, and dragonflies. Jessica Ware, the curator of invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, one of the project's principal investigators, leads a research group for cockroaches and termites. These insects are a nightmare in our homes, but are part of nature's intricate workings outside them. Only 2% of cockroach species are pests, while the other 7,000 or so species are benign. Ware says, actually, a lot of them are really pretty, says Eliza Grames, a biology at Binghamton University and another project leader. Similarly, termites, which are a kind of cockroach, break down old trees and are vital to tropical forest health. Everywhere, Ware says, they are an important food source for birds when they swarm during mating. She has even seen birds feasting on termite swarms in New Jersey. The Insect Network Project grew out of an early initiative by Grames, who started as a bird researcher and became an expert in large-scale data analysis, and an entomologist friend named Graham Montgomery. The researchers realized that many existing research papers tagged with insect data were actually calculations of birds' food. So they designed a system to mine published research for data about insects' population levels. It was a weird series of events, and now that's everything I do, Grames says. Grames believes that repeating long-term studies from decades ago is critical for understanding why insects have declined. While some issues are known, for example, habitat loss, non-native plants, artificial light at night, climate, and pesticides, scientists need to know a lot more about the drivers and consequences of the decline to conserve insects while protecting human needs. Repeating previous bird and insect studies is what Narengo is doing on top of Mount Mansfield. VCE scientists have been studying birds there since the 1990s. As the scientists weighed, measured, and banded birds on Mount Mansfield, decade after decade, they also collected feathers, placing them in envelopes for future study. The envelopes sit in boxes in a corner of VCE's lab in the village of White River Junction. Narengo plans to have those feathers analyzed for the natural variations in their carbon and nitrogen isotopes, which will uncover clues about each bird's diet. For example, she'll be able to tell if they ate mostly plants in their seeds, or mostly plant-eating birds, plant-eating animals, such as caterpillars, or mostly animals that eat other animals, such as spiders. To have a recent comparison, Narengo's team collects feathers from 6 species on Mount Mansfield, including juncos. Another scientist plucked a tail feather from the rumpled young junco and snapped off half of a still-attached wing feather, dropping the samples into a small manila envelope. Durango will analyze those feathers for carbon and nitro isotopes, too. Going one step further, Narango also pricked a vein in the Junco's wing and gathered a drop of blood in a capillary tube. After it is analyzed for isotopes, the blood sample will give her an even more recent snapshot of what the bird has been eating. That is not all the bird has to offer. As it waited its turn to have its blood collected, it sat on a brown paper bag with a piece of filter paper on the bottom. Narango checked the bag, and yes, the baby Junco had pooped there a while. It waited, leaving a grayish smear on the paper. This bird poop was scientific gold. Run through DNA analysis, it would tell Narango everything this bird has eaten in the last few hours, right down to the species. It's a level of specificity that has only recently become available. And for scientists studying this interaction between insects and birds, it's hard to beat. As Narango and others collected data on the birds, Zoe Pickett, a VCE summer intern and undergraduate at Mount Holyoke College, tended the traps set for ground insects. Every week throughout the summer, Pickett emptied dozens of plastic cups that had been filled with a thick liquid preservative and buried in the ground up to their rims, waiting for crawling insects to stumble in. She folded the filter containing the insects and placed it first in a plastic bag, and then in an empty plastic cat food jar, and finally in her yellow backpack. Pickett says that multiple layers of packaging are vital, since slugs, mollusks, not insects, end up falling into the liquid and their smell is uniquely bad. Back in the lab, Amber Jones, a VCE technician, transferred the insect samples into a petri dish and examined them under a microscope. Carabid beetles, a type of ground beetle, were particularly interesting to the team because they were a focus of the University of Vermont researcher who gathered data on the spot 30 years ago. That researcher wrote a report just on Mount Mansfield's carabid beetles, and the Narango's team is identifying each species to compare results. They all look small and black, Narango said, but under the microscope you can see the fine differences between them. Jones sorted the creatures in a petri dish with a tweezer, placing a spider into a one crimped edged aluminum dish, the springtails into another, and the mites, which lived up to their name, in a third. The dishes were labeled, dried in an oven at 140 degrees Fahrenheit for 24 hours, then weighed. The results gave the researchers a picture of which insects were available for a ground-feeding bird like the baby Junco to eat the week the samples were collected. The night before the baby Junco landed in the research team's net, a strange shifting light filtered through the forest, not far from where the Long Trail, Vermont's end-to-end hiking route, traverses the Mount Mansfield ridgeline. I sometimes wonder if hikers going by think aliens have landed, Narango said. A closer inspection would not have dispelled their suspicions. The source of light, which shifted from blue to green to white, whose secret ingredient is ultraviolet, sat in the middle of what would have been an alien lantern, with the otherworldly light bulb supported in a mystifying structure of translucent plastic. It was a moth trap with a funnel below the light to catch the moths drawn in from the surrounding forest. Narango had just finished the five-gallon hardware store bucket that sat below the filter with a jumble of comfy cut-up egg cartons. The moths could rest among them before a jar of ammonia carbonate, also known as smelling salts or baker's ammonia, hidden at the bottom of the bucket killed them. We are looking for non-lethal methods, but some species of moths you have to kill to identify, Narango said. And that's what they were doing in the past, so we stuck with that. When she collected the bucket the next morning and searched through the egg cartons, she didn't find much. One spectacularly patterned geometrid moth, better known for its inchworm caterpillars, and three micro-leaf molar moths. There was a caddisfly in the bucket, which is a type of aquatic insect, and a few tiny flies. The hall let Narango know which caterpillars are available for birds on the mountain, as each of these moths was a caterpillar once. She doesn't survey for butterflies because birds don't eat them or their caterpillars often. Butterflies are colorful because they are typically toxic, or at least taste bad to birds, she explains. Not even their caterpillars make good baby bird food. With their flashy colors, she says, butterflies are just trying too hard. Narango emphasizes that the poor catch is not an example of insect decline, but a result of a particularly chilly summer night. This is what makes insect research so tricky. If Narango only sampled moths on this chilly night in early August, she would get a different idea than if she only sampled them on a warm night at the end of May, when moths were so plentiful on Mount Mansfield that they covered both the inside and outside of the bucket. This is why she sets the light trap every week of the field season. Though Narango and her colleagues don't yet have a final count of moths and ground insects or their species, she noticed that they were collecting many fewer moths than the research team had 30 years ago. They collected their moths in a garbage can, Narango said. She was using a mere 5-gallon bucket. On the other hand, her team was collecting more carabid ground beetles than presented 30 years ago, and more of the beetles they collected were high elevation specialists. This may be climate refugia, Narango said, referring to a place that remains relatively unchanged during major shifts in climate. The top of Mount Mansfield has been spared from the development happening in the world below over the past 30 years. Narango has an idea of what's ahead for the baby junco and other birds on the mountain. She previously studied birds in cities, and she found that in places with fewer native plants, there were fewer protein and fat-rich caterpillars, so the chickadees she studied turned to eating spiders, which are lower in fat instead. In these places, the chickadees laid fewer eggs and fewer hatchlings survived to leave the nest. Grames' research shows that the quantity of insects available to birds matters. When there are more insects in a habitat, she says, birds raise fatter, happier chicks. Chris Elfrick of the University of Connecticut, who now helps lead the Status of Insects Network, says, if you're a swallow, maybe some insects are more likely eating steak and 2 veg, and others are like eating lettuce all the time. Even knowing the strong evidence of global insect decline, neither Grames nor Narango despairs over the fate of birds and insects. They are optimistic that while they wait for policy changes, simple everyday actions can make a difference. They advise using fewer outside lights, which attract insects, distracting them from sometimes to the point of death, from starvation or exhaustion, or making them vulnerable to predators like spiders. It helps when lights are motion-activated and yellow, or another warm color, since insects are attracted to bright white light. They also recommend using fewer insecticides. Narango knows from her own research that planting native plants in a yard or even a pot on an apartment balcony can help provide high-protein insect food for birds. Planting a single tree can make a difference, with an oak supporting up to 557 species of caterpillars. People who may not be motivated to save the insects for their own sake, but a world without insects is a world without birds. It's a world where no college student will hear the fluty song of a white-throated sparrow across a mountain lake and have her life changed. It's a world where nature offers no song to the rising sun. It's a silent spring. In the long term, it would become something even worse. Without insects, everything dies. All animals, mammals, reptiles, all birds, and even humans, Ware says. If you want to conserve any of those things, including us, you should want to conserve insects. What Narango did after making sure the Junco's needle prick had healed looked like a magic trick, but it came merely from years of experience. She fluttered her hands, a set of maneuvers to give the bird a firm launching pad, and then suddenly the Junco was free. It flew to the top of the blue shadows of a patch of balsam firs near the top of Mount Mansfield. It was time to find breakfast. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Classic Rock by Jenny Rothenberg Gritz. Artisans around the world are ditching the mortar and embracing the ancient craft of dry stone walling. John Shaw Remington started building dry stone walls after the stones themselves complained to him. It was the 1980s and he was living in Ontario, working for clients who wanted decorative stone veneers affixed to the sides of concrete walls. The stones were saying, "We are not decoration. Do you understand?" And I said, "Yeah, I get it." Shaw Remington ditched the concrete and helped revive the ancient craft of dry stone walling. A dry stone wall is made of nothing but stones, carefully fitted together in such a way that the wall won't fall down. Gluing the stones with mortar, a paste made of lime or cement mixed with sand and water, is simpler in the short term, but when a dry stone wall breaks, it's easy to repair. You just have to fix one section and the wall as a whole remains secure. When a mortared wall cracks, the entire wall is in peril. We dry stonewallers call mortar the devil's glue, Strom Remington said. It smears and it stains and it owns you. Can you make stonewalling no fun at all? Yeah, try and put mortar in it. People figured out how to make dry stone walls thousands of years ago. In Scotland, dry stone structures date back as far as 5,000 years to the actual Stone Age. The Maya ruins in Lubantun, Belize, built around the 8th or 9th century AD, used dry stone construction. So did the Great Enclosure, an enormous complex in Zimbabwe built between the 13th and 14th centuries. The Japanese dry stone craft of Anno Zumi thrived in the 17th century. The very fact that these walls still stand in any form speaks to the strength of their construction. Dry stone walls appear all over Britain after 1604, when so-called enclosure acts divided common lands among the elite. The tradition carried on from there. When photographer Christy Hem-Clock traveled to Scotland, she found dry stone boundary walls just down the road from ancient stone settlements like Clactalbroke. The building style was so common throughout the country that Scottish locals couldn't understand why she found the wall so interesting. I would pull over to photograph a wall, and people would ask me, "What are you taking a picture of? That's just a wall that holds in sheep." But a dry stone wall doesn't have to look like a sheep pen. An imaginative builder can put the stones together in all sorts of combinations. You start by digging a trench about 3 to 6 inches deep and filling it with gravel. And you assemble each layer, one stone over two, two stones over one. You can shape the stones with a hammer and chisel as you see fit. Some of them, called tie-through stones, need to go all the way from one side to the other. Others, called hearting stones, are lemon-sized wedges that keep the interior structure intact. As you build upward, the wall should get narrower. At the end, you set heavy coping stones along the top. As long as you stick to these and other basic principles, you can make all kinds of choices about colors, shapes, and patterns. I always tell my clients it doesn't have to be these big rustic walls, says Christy DeGaris, a dry stone waller in Scotland. You can create really modern lines, a really neat structure. You can space the stones out evenly and create a nice visual flow. You can do pretty much anything with dry stone, actually. DeGaris also tells her clients that a dry stone wall is an investment in the future. It's a proper legacy thing. Mortar walls need to be redone roughly every 15 to 30 years. But there are dry stone walls still standing after thousands of years. What price do you put on forever? You won't find many dry stone walls in the western United States. When the country expanded, the easiest way to divide properties and fence in animals was with wood and wire. There was no need to build structures that would last, especially given how rapidly the boundaries were changing. But you can find them in New England. Farmers clearing the forest piled up the rocks partly to get them out of the way. The walls they made weren't always meticulously constructed, as Robert Frost hints in his 1914 poem, Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall. That sends the frozen ground swell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun. It makes gap even two can pass abreast. He describes the process of mending the wall with his neighbor, picking up the rocks that have fallen to each side. And some are loaves and some are so nearly balls. We have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. Frost knew how to craft a poem, but he didn't quite understand how to put together a wall. I would say some of my earlier work was kind of like that, Daniel Peterson, a landscape designer and dry stone walling instructor in the Twin Cities, said with a chuckle. In our workshops, we teach certain techniques for building with different shaped stones, including round stone. Ideally, you don't want to cross your fingers as you walk away and hope that it stands up. Frost was also wrong about the frost. A well-built wall won't fall down when the frozen ground swells under it. Peterson can attest to this after years of living and working in Minnesota. When you see a concrete wall, it's very rigid and has no flexibility. Whereas when you're building with dry stone, it's like weaving a rope. It can move and shift as the ground freezes and thaws. Last summer, Peterson traveled to Northern California to teach a dry stone walling workshop there. Krista Monet, the local landscape designer who organized the event, had been struggling to find craftspeople who knew how to carry out her dry stone wall designs. So she reached out to the horticulture program at the nearby junior college and to retired people and homeowners who wanted to build walls on their property. 16 people showed up to learn from Peterson. I'm really trying to mobilize our region and get people interested in these stone walls, explains Monet, who first fell in love with the structures while she was living in France. These walls can be fire breaks between vineyards and homes. If there's a grass fire coming through, it will stop at the wall. Well-built walls can also be stable during earthquakes, which may seem surprising given there's nothing to hold them together. But while mortar cracks, well-fitted stones can nestle in even more tightly after the ground shakes. And when portions break, they're easy to fix. Remember, these walls have been built around the world forever, Monet pointed out. When you go to Japan, you see dry stone walls that withstood giant earthquakes just fine. When it comes to aesthetics, Monet has a different challenge than that one Daguerre faces in Scotland. Monet's California clients have no preconceived ideas about dry stone walls. They don't feel particularly bound in any tradition. They can build a Japanese garden, an English garden, an Italian garden, or anything they choose, but they tend to be drawn to modern materials they see on Pinterest. I tell them that while synthetic materials like vinyl can look really good, there's a loss of connection when we're surrounded by them, Monet says. When we find ourselves surrounded by natural materials, I think that's a feeling of relief. But it can be hard to explain to people why they're going to enjoy the stone wall so much more than a stucco wall. You just have to feel it. Dry stone walls can serve all kinds of functions, but they're also beautiful just for their own sake. David F. Wilson, a waller from Dundee, Scotland, uses the medium for public art. In his creations, you can see distinct patterns of color, size, and shape. It's a brilliant material for public spaces because it's very robust, says Wilson. There's basically no maintenance, and because it's very textured, it tends to not attract graffiti or vandalism. In 2016, Wilson received a Churchill Fellowship, a grant that sends British citizens abroad for 4 to 8 weeks to study advancements in their field. Wilson traveled to North America to learn about new developments in dry stone walling. People there are finding their own way of working with stone, and that allows a degree of more personality to come into the work. He was astonished when he traveled to New Windsor, New York, and saw Storm King Wall, an art installation by English artist Andy Goldsworthy. The wall, which was built in the late 1990s and is 2,270 feet long, undulates instead of forming a rigid line. It's got this interesting dynamic movement, says Wilson. The wall is not a barrier. It weaves in and out of the trees in a way that makes spaces for the trees to shine. A few years after Storm King Wall made its debut, Peter Mullins, a landowner in Mendocino, California, decided he wanted to invite stone artists to his ranch. He brought in craftspeople from far and wide, supplying catered meals and kegs of beer as they worked. The site became known as Mendocino Stone Zone, later the Mendocino Stone Ranch. At Mullins' request, Shaw Remington came down from Canada to build a dry stone stagecoach house. The project amused Shaw Remington. He'd never been in an actual stagecoach house built in the way, and certainly not in California. As someone who communes with his materials, Shaw Remington had to make some adjustments in California. Most of the stones at his disposal are left over from projects and didn't have a uniform aesthetic. A lot of the rock along the California coast was also less durable than the fieldstone that he's used to working with back in Ontario. The stones it seemed were inviting us to be counterintuitive, he said. Once a wall is complete, he said, the vibrant creative energy remains. You can sit in front of a well-built dry stone wall and it's like watching television. You could sit there and look all day, just enjoying the fits, enjoying the way the colors come together. Kind of pours out. Doesn't get tiresome. As he sees it, people who use recreational drugs are only trying to get something like this natural high. He added with a mischievous laugh, there's a reason they call it getting stoned. That article was cut for time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.